Welcome to the Town Hall Theatre in Galway and to this Arena Druid O'Casey special. On stage with me, the company of Druid O'Casey and their director, Gary Hines. It was William Shakespeare who said that all the world's a stage, but for one of Ireland's greatest playwrights, Sean O'Casey, that world and that stage comprised the tenements of his native Dublin. There, in the overcrowded rooms that sheltered the poor, O'Casey found stories of ordinary people living in extraordinary times, and those stories became the fodder for his three great Dublin plays, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, and Juno and the Paycock. All of them set during cataclysmic national events, the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, and the Civil War. Some 100 years later, in Galway, the internationally acclaimed Druid Theatre Company and its artistic director, Gary Hines, had a passion to put on these three plays. Now that dream has been realised as the company staged the trilogy of O'Casey works at the Galway International Arts Festival before embarking on a national and international tour. You find us, as I say, on the Town Hall Theatre stage on the set of the third play in the series, Juno and the Paycock. We're sitting in the home of Captain Boyle and his wife, Juno. More of that later. But let us start at the beginning. On stage with me are some of the cast of the first play that we see in the trilogy, The Plough and the Stars. Marty Ray, who plays the young Covey, Erin Monaghan, who plays Cluther Good, Sophie Langlinger, who plays Nora Clitheroe, Hilda Fay, who plays Bessie Burgess, Anna Healy, who plays Rosie Redmond, and Catherine Walsh, who plays the woman from Rathmines. And in the middle of them all, artistic director Gary Hines. I suppose we start with these three plays, Gary, and why are they so important in terms of Irish theatre? Why are they so important in terms of O'Casey?
Well, in terms of O'Casey, they're generally regarded as his best work, although you'd find interesting arguments for and against that. But also, in a fairly unique way, they actually tell the story of the founding of the Irish state. So that at the, we do them in chronological order, and when Plough and the Stars open, it's 2015, probably about autumn 2015, and by the time we go to our second act, it's 2016, and it's the Easter Rising. And then the two plays that follow cover the War of Independence and the Civil War. So I don't know any country which has its, if you like, to use a cliche, its origin story as a nation, as a state, so clearly chronicled by a great writer for the theatre. And I think we're very lucky to have them. And I think it's fascinating to be able to see the plays together, whether you see them in sequence over three nights or whether you see them together all on one day.
And what's really interesting in terms of O'Casey, we are seeing these big historical events, that origin story, as you say, of this nation, but seeing it through the eyes predominantly of poor people living in the tenements of Dublin. Yeah. O'Casey, they say, write what you know. O'Casey was writing what he knew. He was stuck there in the middle of this himself.
He very much was, and he was writing about the people he knew. I mean, there is even a story that I don't know whether it's true or not, that there was a Fluther Good at the time living in the North Wall who threatened to take a libel action against him because he included him in the play. So he's effectively writing the play about the people on the margins. And you'd hear throughout three plays an enormous amount of debate about why and arguments for and against, but these are people who are not, except for a few of them, directly involved in the events, but are trying to make lives on the margins of those events.
And the politics that O'Casey gives us across the three plays, his own history is interesting in that respect, in that early on he was a member of the Irish Citizens Army, but he moved away from that military side of things, and he very much was more motivated by the political side and the labour movement, that side of things, wasn't he?
Very much so. I mean, he was a socialist and a communist all his life. And he, as you say, he was involved in the ICA, but he did not go out in Easter week because he didn't agree with it. He's one of those people that didn't agree with it. And you can hear his arguments, you know, being actually created through the plays, which is wonderful.
And he allows the characters to argue with each other in the way that the nation was doing at the time. The other thing that he does, because as we describe it here, it sounds as if it's a history lesson. Yeah. I never had a history lesson at school where I laughed as much as I did when I got the history lesson that I got from these three plays. That emphasis of O'Casey on comedy is so important in these plays. But comedy and tragedy, they sit side by side all the time. You're waiting for one to fold into the other. I suppose that's one of the great achievements of the plays.
I think it is. You know, he is capable, and we've seen it, of, you know, having an audience laughing one moment and turned suddenly around and watching tragedy on the other. That's a great skill. And I think it comes somewhere from what his influences were. He was in amateur theatre when he was young. In fact, he played Father Dolan in the Colleen Bawn. And those were the influences that he came to and that helped him create a dramaturgy that is unlike anything certainly written before that. And if it's written after it, it's simply an O'Casey version of what he did.
And the other aspect of that comedy and drama thing is, you know, in some ways he was touching on the ability of the Irish, contemporary Irish, as much as the Irish of a century ago, to kind of, it's only a bit of a joke, let's laugh at our troubles and joke them off into nowhere. By putting the tragedy in beside the laughter, he stops us from doing that.
He absolutely does. But, you know, in the course of the plays, and as they began to emerge in both Abbey productions and other productions, he was called, I think mistakenly, a naturalist, that his dramaturgy was of the naturalist kind, naturalism. I don't believe that at all, and I think it probably arose from the fact that he was writing about poor people, about people on the margins of society, with the same reverence and seriousness as if they were kings and queens. And I think that's where that sense came about. Mm. But he was an extraordinary creator of theatre spectacle, theatre character, theatre relationships, and then just that language, that glorious, glorious language, which is one of the great weapons of O'Casey in the play.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could hardly call the language naturalism. There's all kinds of styles in there. Yeah, there are realistic aspects. These are real people in real situations. There's expressionism in there. There's definitely melodrama in there. Yeah. There's a real music hall and song feel to the plays as well, particularly in Juno later on, we get that. All of those are important to the style of theatre that I suppose you had to go for across the trilogy.
Yes, absolutely. You know, he uses music in the way music was used. Like, for instance, in the middle of Juno, there's a party and everybody's expected to sing or recite a poem or whatever. And so music was an essential part of his life and an essential part of their lives. And he uses that unashamedly in helping make the plays. And it gives a quality that is joyous and glorious in terms of its ability to celebrate the small things in life.
And of course, it's highly entertaining, which is, you know, O'Casey knew what he was at in those terms. We're going to go through the plays in the programme this evening. We're going to go through them in order as you perform them in the trilogy itself, which is the historical order of the events. So the trilogy begins, Gary, with The Plough and the Stars. I think you could argue this is in some ways the most complex of the three plays, certainly in terms of the arguments that we get set out on the stage in front of us, the political arguments and the social arguments that are given to us. And we're into politics almost immediately in the interaction between young Covey and Uncle Peter. Just bring us into the world of The Plough and the Stars, first of all, Gary, and I'll broaden it out to the cast then.
Well, we're coming into the home of four of the characters, Nora and her husband, Jack Clitheroe, and her uncle, Peter, and a cousin, the Covey. The Covey is the most character that most resembles O'Casey. But there's tension between the newly married couple, Nora, and her husband, because he wants to go out to fight or wants to certainly be part of the independence movement. She doesn't. She wants to make a life for her and for her family. And through that argument, we follow some of the arguments, both for those arguments must have been going on in many other homes as well. And so it's wonderful because with those four people coming on stage, you see Uncle Peter in the uniform of the foresters, which is mid-19th century, and then the modernity of the ideas of Nora and the Covey, who's one of those people you sincerely hope you won't get pushed into a corner in a pub with, because he will never shut up.
Yeah. So Marty Ray is the actor tasked with doing that, cornering people in the pub, Marty. But the young Covey, I suppose he probably is the character, I think it's safe to say, whose opinions most resemble those of O'Casey, perhaps. But O'Casey, being the playwright that he is, he doesn't make you just a mouthpiece for his political thoughts. How does he bring that character from being just more than somebody stating political opinions, but no flesh and blood underneath? What does he give the character?
He gives him light and shade as a character. So he does have all his communism and socialist stuff. He's read the books. Well, he says he's read the books a lot, but I think he probably has. You think he's a very suave political thinker or socialist thinker, but at the same time, he's drawn into this kind of tit for tat torture of Uncle Peter, who's an older member of his family that he just can't ignore an opportunity to drive this man mad. So you're looking at, he's like a child in that way and a very astute thinker in another way. So you kind of juggle that.
Yeah, and the other side of that is, if he is the nearest in opinion to O'Casey, O'Casey does not make him the nicest and the best character in the play.
No, not at all. He's almost unbearable.
Yeah.
And it was funny because there was an RTE radio documentary done about O'Casey, where people, I think it was made in the 80s, and there were people in their 80s talking about, who remembered him from the time, and an awful lot of the time they were saying, no, he was a bit curmudgeonly, or he was a bit kind of grumpy or whatever. So the whole idea that not everyone is 100% one thing all the time is very true with the Covey and everybody else.
Yeah, and as we were here, as Gary was saying, you as the young Covey are sharing accommodation then with Nora, played by Sophie Lenglinger, who's with us here as well. And Sophie, your character, Nora, she's newly married. The domestic setup here, I mean, it would try the patience of a saint, really, when you think of it. The home is jam-packed full of people who are just getting in the way of this young couple. Yeah. She's madly in love, but madly in love with a fella who wants to go out and fight.
Yeah, I think for her, it's all about creating a safe haven, you know, and the odds are stacked against her, you know, every aspect of she's trying to escape, I think, the tenement life. And, you know, even though there's this beautiful sense of community, she comes home and Uncle Peter and the Covey are arguing. Jack probably doesn't come home every evening. You know, he's off at the meetings. And I think all that she wants is to build a better life for herself and for her family. But it doesn't, for the people of the tenements, it doesn't come across that way always. There is a sense of her wanting to separate herself. You know, we come in and she's put a lock on the door. She's trying to separate herself, but also, you know, to create that safe space, you know? And I think for newlyweds, that's all they want, you know? They want to start a new life, a better life, and it doesn't really seem like it's going that way.
Yeah, it doesn't pan out. And in terms of, you know, you say this thing about the idea of putting the lock on the door, and there is that lovely scene where she locks the door, and you know, it's the intimacy between the newly married couple is what she's hoping to engender there. But in some ways, does she want to shut out the outside events, the cataclysmic events that are happening outside? Is that what her ultimate desire is? And can she ignore them?
I think her ultimate desire is just to build a better life. I think the shutting out is a form of escape, you know, even mentally, you know. I think that it'd be easier for her to, again, like, separate herself so that she can provide, even as, you know, she probably wants to be a mother. She wants to be a good wife. And for her, that means being, you know, better than what she believes the tenements are, you know, which isn't against the tenement people. It's just the conditions that they live in, you know.
Erin Monaghan is sitting beside you, who plays Fruith or Good. Have any of the Fruith or Good's descendants been in touch with you about this character, as Gary says? Because he, in some ways, he provides some of the great comic moments in this play as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. And just kind of listen to what the guys are saying there. And I think it's the same for all these characters. There's brilliant hypocrisy in each of these characters. So he's a roaring alcoholic in many respects, but he's a terribly decent man. He's a very lofty opinion of himself. And I'm sure he believes in the Irish independence movement, but he's still not going to go out and fight for it. Mm. So he just gives you great material to play with there, dramatically and comedically. And the way he constructs a line.
He gives Fluter some great language. He gives everybody great language, but Fluter in particular.
I can only kind of equate it to someone like Singh, who takes a very colloquial language, but also makes it poetic and operatic and epic at the same time. And no matter how good a performer you are, you're never going to get the better of O'Casey.
Yeah, his language is something else. Hilda Fey, playing the character of Bessie Burgess in The Plough and the Stars, she represents maybe a voice that is not often heard in the midst of this particular story. She's quite definitely of a unionist background. Her son is fighting in the First World War.
She's a Protestant warrior, is what she is. But she has a very strong voice through this. And she's definitely not afraid to use it. She's a truth sayer. Mm. But I found in the process of playing her that she's also quite similar to Juno in ways that she is a mother. And she is grieving the loss of her son going to a war, fighting in the World War, and living in a tenement where nobody values that. And the resentment and the anger and the frustration is bubbling in her, you know, all the way through the play. But what O'Casey does and what he does best is he shows the humanity in man. And never judge a book by your cover, because she's the hero in the end. And what I love about O'Casey is he has written in all his plays the female hero in a time where, you know, women hadn't got a voice and they weren't represented. So I will eternally love him for that.
And you give us it both in Bessie and in Juno, which we'll talk
for
about
sure.
later on. He's not so kind, Catherine Walsh, to the woman from Rough Minds, is he? That is one. It's the big comic. It's a huge comic moment in the production. She is out of her depth in the wrong part of town, I'm afraid, isn't she?
She is and the trams are all stopped on O'Connell Street. Otherwise, she'd have been out of there. But that was not to be.
But it is interesting that, and obviously you have the challenge of playing her, there's great fun within that, but he's not kind to the lady from Rathmines, really, is he?
No, he's not, and I love, I've been stopped here in a coffee shop the other day, say, did she ever get there? Did she get back to Rathmines?
Did she get home?
So, and I flip between saying, no, she got shot, and saying, no, she got home safe. But I love that. It's happened to me twice. Has she got home? Which is, I actually thought I was sitting here for Shadow, because Marty and Anna are in Shadow. So I'm thrilled I'm here for the lady from Rathmines. Go, Rathmines, go.
One of the big moments in The Plough, let us be honest. And the final member that we have here from The Plough for this moment is Anna Healy. Anna, maybe you could go over, because you're going to perform a song for us. Maybe you'd go over beside musical director Conor Linehan, and you might give us the context for where the wonderful Rosie Redmond is when she's singing this song, and what she's seeking to do, which is important in the story.
Well, Rosie Redmond, my gorgeous character, is the sex worker, and she's from the tenements, from the Monto in Dublin. And her story is all set in the second act of the play. And the first act is all the cataclysmic, setting up all the cataclysmic political, men going to war, men getting ready for the rising. So trade's not so good for poor Rosie. So she spends the whole act, and she's a woman in desperation. She's trying to make the rent. She's trying to turn a trick. She tries everyone that comes through the bar door and eventually manages to lure the lowest and poorest of them all, Luther Coote, at the end. And she manages and sings to him. Mm. The act ends with her cradling his head in her very ample bosom.
And the words that you speak, the words that you speak in the middle of this are to Luther himself.
Oh, to Luther, to finally lure him out of there. She's tried everything. Once had a lover, a tailor, but he could do nothing for me. Dancing a jiggy in the bed.
We'll be back with more from this Druid O'Casey special after this break. And welcome back to this Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, celebrating Druid Theatre Company's production of the Sean O'Casey trilogy of Dublin plays, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, and Juno and the Paycock. And now we move on to play number two, The Shadow of a Gunman. But maybe just before we go to that, Conor Lenehan, you were playing the music there. How does the music link all of these three plays together? What's the key to getting them into one unit?
The key was tricky in a way, because you start with nothing. You start with, you've got the plays, but you start with a blank piece of paper. I think I would go back to what you were speaking about earlier about the fine line that is drawn between tragedy and comedy. There's a great line in Shadow, I think it is, about that the Irish love to make a joke out of a serious thing and a serious thing out of a joke. And this was a sort of starting point, that the music would be vaudevillian, that it would be kind of fun, it would be lively, but that it would just have a little bit of lemon juice in it.
Yeah. A little bit of bitterness.
Yeah, a little bit of bitterness in it, a little bit of drama in it. A couple of years ago, we did the O'Casey three short comedies, and that was a great sort of starting point from the comedic point of view, and a great chance to explore different textures. So I think I brought quite a bit of that into the score, but with a kind of an underlying more sense of menace and seriousness, I hope.
And coming back to you then, Gary, and let's move into to play number two. Conor has mentioned it there, the Shadow of a Gunman. We're into the kind of the period here during the War of Independence. This isn't a glorious war. There are no great heroes here. This isn't any kind of glorification. He is really annoyed with everybody in this play.
Absolutely. And we open the scene with two men, one in the bed, which is Seamus Cheese, and Donald Davern tapping out on his typewriter, trying to write poetry against the various interruptions and eruptions into their lives. And in the course of time, they argue the toss on what's happening outside. But we can also now hear that the guns are coming nearer. Mm. And, you know, it's the sense of the growing involvement, whether people like it or not, their growing involvement in the events, because it's happening all around them.
And Rory Nolan, you're playing the part of Seamus Shields, another one of O'Casey's characters who talks a lot. Boy, does he like the sound of his own voice.
Yeah, a huge stretch for me. He does. And he has that amazing, I think Aaron touched on it earlier on, this incredible hypocrisy that O'Casey explores all the time. He talks a great deal about teaching Irish six nights a week, and when he paid his rifle levy like a man in the Irish Republican Brotherhood, and, you know, he tarred a prayer for the repose of James Stephen Solon, the steps of the Pro Cathedral. But when it comes to the crunch, when it comes to actually literally having a gun put to his head, it's a very different story. And he's written these characters that are very good at, pardon the pun, but peacocking about who they are.
Yeah, which will come up again later.
Yeah, and presenting a certain persona to each other. But that is very much at odds when they're faced with a very physical dilemma straight in front of their face.
Yeah, and Donald Avarin then, Marty Ray, this your character this time. And again, you could argue this is O'Casey having a laugh at himself, because Donald Avarin is the writer, is poet, the poet. Yeah. He's all of those things now. O'Casey may have been getting at another aspect of cultural nationalism through this character as well. But he is unkind to this writer as well. He makes a right idiot out of him.
Yeah, yeah. A poet and poltroon, he calls himself at the end. But, I mean, I think the Sean O'Casey link is interesting. We found that we were reading a bit about there was a time that O'Casey had moved in with a fella in, I think it was Mountjoy Square or somewhere like that, and shared digs with this guy who they were thrown out by the landlord and, you know, given the... You got to be out by this date. And when we looked at the date on the real piece of paper, it's the date that he echoes in the play, the 28th or whatever it is. So it's very real things.
We were talking about the tenements earlier on. It has the touch of reality off it. How realistic is the language that he gives to him here? He does ask him for some florid stuff, doesn't he?
Yeah, very flowery stuff. I mean, he's reciting lots of poetry. He's big into Shelley. So, I mean, he's very poetically minded. But I think when it comes down to it, he's just like everybody else. And really the whole kind of push of the narrative is that he's willing to pretend to be a gunman in order to get off with someone. Yeah. So,
well, you know what? We'll hold off on that. We'll hear that little scene in just a minute. So here we are back at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway discussing The Shadow of the Gunman, the second in the O'Casey trilogy, currently in performance by Druid Theatre Company. Marty Ray was setting up the character of Donald Davern for us just before the break, and how he wants to get off, to use your term, Marty, with Minnie Powell, played by Katrina Ennis. So Katrina and Marty are going to go over to the performance mics now and give us a little section from The Shadow of a Gunman, where we find out the attraction in Donald Davern, the attraction that is there for Minnie Powell. So this is from The Shadow of a Gunman.
Would you have a sweetheart all the same, Mr. Davern? Haven't you?
Aye? No, not one, Minnie.
Now you can tell that to someone else. Aren't you a poet? And aren't all the girls fond of poets?
Well, that may be, but all the poets aren't fond of girls.
They are in the storybooks, aye. And fond of more than one, too. Are you fond of them, Mr. Davern?
Of course I like girls, Minnie, especially girls that can add to their charms by the way in which they dress. Like you, for instance.
Ah, now you're on for codding me, Mr. Davern.
No, really, Minnie, I'm not. You're a very charming little girl indeed.
Well, if I'm a charming little girl, you ought to be able to write a poem about me.
So I will. So I will, Minnie. I've written them about girls not half so pretty as yourself.
I knew you had one. I knew you had one now.
Nonsense. Every girl a poet writes about isn't his sweetheart. Annie Laurie wasn't the sweetheart of Bobby Burns.
You needn't tell me she wasn't. And for bonny Annie Laurie, I'd lay me down and die. No man would lay down and die for Annie but a sweetheart, not even for a wife.
No man many willingly dies for anything.
Except for his country, like Robert Emmet.
Even he would have lived on if he could. He died not to deliver the Irish nation. The British government killed him to save the British nation.
Well, you're only joking now. You'd die for your country.
I don't know so much about that.
You would. I know what you are.
What am I?
A gunman on the run.
Katrina Ennis as Minnie Powell and Marty Ray there as Donald Davern in the scene from The Shadow of a Gunman. And when we listen to that, Gary Hines, in some ways you think, Gary, is this his funniest play? He really knocks fun out of all sides of the argument here. But how cynical is he about all sides of the argument?
I think there's a fair degree of cynicism there. But what he does is he gives that cynicism to the characters themselves. During our troubled times, well after these plays, a lot of the lines in Shadow of a Gunman became things that were used to describe the attitude of the Irish when it came to issues like these. Mm-hmm. So he's it's his ability, I suppose, to actually, have capable of doing effectively broad farce and then the next second turn around to something truly terrible that ends at the end of the play, and to encompass that all within 90 minutes of writing.
And he's writing these plays very close to the events that are actually happening in real time in the beginning of the 20th century. Is that part of what got him into trouble with Irish society at the time, that he was holding a mirror up to their face?
Well, I think he got in trouble in all sorts of places. It was a very febrile time anyhow. So, there are various... The stories come down in different ways. Even members of the Abbey Company who were cast in things like Plough and the Stars objected to, say, something like Rosie the Prostitute being in them. When he was being provocative, that was fully intended by him to be provocative. But to think that Abbey audiences saw three new plays of this extraordinary kind of writing about their actual day-to-day lives at this incredibly important period politically over a period of 6 years.
Yeah.
What an experience that must have been.
And Robbie O'Connor is with us, who plays Tommy Owens in the midst of The Shadow of the Gunman. And that scene that we just heard between Minnie Powell and Donald Davern, Katrina Ennis and Marty Ray playing the parts, Robbie, your character of Tommy Owens, he's as caught up in this idea of the glorious gunman as anything else, isn't
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. It's funny because, again, it goes back to that theme of the hypocrisy of O'Casey's men. He's so enamoured with the idea that this IRA general might be downstairs, and yet... Like, the play is set against the backdrop of a war with the rise of Michael Collins, and a war that either fails or succeeds on clandestine operation and discretion. And Tommy Owens so badly wants to be a part of that and yet can't shut up about it.
And Katrina, in many ways, if you think about it, the character of Minnie Powell, even though in the scene that we just heard, she clearly is totally enamoured of this poet and the romance of all of that, and the fact that he might be a gunman makes him even more attractive. Mm. As things turn out, she is probably one of the most idealistic characters in this play.
Yeah. A Helena Troy come to live in a tenement.
Yeah.
They call it. For me, I think Minnie is like a stray kitten that was put in a plastic bag, thrown into the Liffey, and she pulled herself out. And she, I think enters into this room naive, but just on the cusp of finding out her own eternal strength and fearlessness. And she's fragile, and she puts it all on this man outside her own world. I think she's frustrated in this house and sick of listening to Tommy sing his songs and sick of all everybody talking. And finally, here's this different creature who writes poetry and is a gunman on the run. And for me, I think she's upstairs writing poetry, but no, it's him. And he's the gunman. And by the end, for me, her journey is actually, she leaves that room at some point going, no, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm the one. I'm the fearless one. I think she leaves with a great sense of herself and a dignity and a fearlessness. And she's a joy to play.
And Cliona Hallacy is also with us here, who designed the costumes across the three plays. Cliona, and I come to you off the back of Minnie, because it's very noticeable the three young women in the plays, Minnie Powell in The Shadow of the Gunman, Nora that we heard about earlier from Sophie in The Plough and the Stars, and Mary that we'll hear about in a while in Juno and the Peacock. They are the best dressed people on stage. There is no doubt about it. I think they were your kind of a key into how you costumed the whole play.
Yeah, my friend, myself and Frances had kind of discussed about how...
It's Frances O'Connor who's the set designer.
Yes, yeah. About how these were women who were really going to punctuate the time for us as well. You know, they don't have that many dependents. They're making their own money and all that kind of stuff. And so dress and how they present themselves is how they set themselves apart. Or then in the case of other women, is how they kind of assimilate. And so colour then was also used. So Nora is in a really kind of bright yellow. Minnie has her little flash of electric blue. And then we have Mary in her lilac. So they each kind of have a colour. And then, which if, I don't know if people will spot it or not, but yellow is kind of carried through with those the three women. Kind of Nora's little pop of yellow appears again in the women.
And the other side of it is, if you give the three young women the best costumes and the most beautiful costumes, there's no doubt that Donald Davern, with his threadbare coat and his half shoes, gets the toughest costume. What did Marty Ray do to deserve that from you?
He requested it, actually. Well, I suppose we were looking at kind of at all of those moments of where we could kind of contrast, I suppose. And also sometimes with costume, there is practicality. Like Marty had a lot of running around to do in that scene, and in order for him not to slip in his socks, the holes got bigger and bigger every time we rehearsed it. So it's, you know.
There'd be no socks at all by the end of the run. Right, we'll take our final break now, and we'll be back with the final play in the trilogy, Juno and the Peacock, after these. And welcome back to this Druid O'Casey special from the Town Hall Theatre in Galway, celebrating Druid Theatre Company's production of the Sean O'Casey trilogy of Dublin plays, The Plough and the Stars, The Shadow of a Gunman, and Juno and the Peacock. And let us go to the third of those plays, Juno and the Peacock, which was first performed on the 3rd of March 1924 at the Abbey Theatre. With me now still, Gary Hines, director, actors Rory Nolan, who plays Captain Boyle, Hilda Fay, who plays Juno, Erin Monaghan, who plays Joxer Daly, Zara Devlin, who plays Mary Boyle, and composer Conor Linehan is still with us as well. Gary, this is probably the most popular of all the plays, and I think it's the latest written, even though it's the earliest. It's the earliest set of events. What is it about this play that you think has made it so popular? Juno and the Peacock. The Peacock is Captain Boyle. Juno is the title character, you could argue here for sure.
Well, I think just as you're saying that they're Juno and the Peacock, these two characters who are so mismatched, but they are husband and wife. I think the other, it's the most conventional in terms of its structure. So he takes a very old-fashioned type of plot used all through the Victorian period, where a family comes into an inheritance, then blow the inheritance and everything goes wrong. He does that very successfully then. He's not particularly interested in that plot, but he in that plot per se, but he is interested in what that plot can do to explore the complexities of the various characters and their situation.
And I guess if you think about the company of actors that he was writing for, that O'Casey was writing for back at that time, Sarah Elgood played Juno, Barry Fitzgerald, Captain Boyle, F.J. McCormick played Joxer. He probably wrote directly to those great stars of the day and to their strengths.
Oh, at this point, he must have been. I think, you know, you can see from looking at the casting over all three plays, there are some people who are common to all three, though they weren't being done, obviously, as a trilogy or anything like that. And I think, you know, shortly after this, now we'll have the big break between over the Silver Tassie between O'Casey and the Abbey, and he goes to England. And I think that he loses probably the most important thing that a writer has when he goes to realise a play in a production, his actors and the relationship he has with those actors and the relationship he's been building with them. And that's all gone. And I always think it must have been so sad for both him and for the theatre and for Dublin audiences.
Yeah, at the time, because they would have been hugely popular. They were the big stars of the day. And Hilda Fay, you were talking, Hilda, to us earlier on about playing the character of Bessie Burgess in The Plough and the Stars. Here you are with Juno in Juno and the Peacock. She is a very different woman, but huge difficulties in front of her, mostly in and around the lazy sods she has around her.
Yeah, she's up against it. You know, she's a victim of her circumstance and through no fault of her own. But she is the quintessential mother role. And I feel such a privilege to play this woman because she really, really is up against it. And she's so strong and just has to keep going and get things done and put bread on the table. And if there's ever a message in these plays, it's the cost of war on the women. You know, and the grief they had to suffer and all that. But, like, there's a great interview with O'Casey on the internet, and he talks about when they stormed the stage in the Abbey, and Yeats got up and he said, "You disgraced yourself again. This is O'Casey's apotheosis." And O'Casey didn't understand what that meant, and he went and he looked it up, and it was, these plays are translated to the gods. And I very much feel that, and especially in Juno's last speech, that these plays are not only speaking to Dublin people, but these plays are Irish, they're our legacy, they're the jewel in our crown, and they speak to the world.
Yeah, very true. And yeah. And when I think about Juno, and of course, the name coming from the gods, obviously, but Juno here and Bessie Burgess in The Plough and the Stars, Protestant working class woman and Bessie, Catholic working class woman in Juno. This is an argument that was often made in and around the Northern Irish trouble, that there was more in common between the Protestant and Catholic working class than was ever explored. Did you feel some kind of, I suppose, connection between the two women, even though they're not even in the same place?
I definitely did. There were two women and two mothers, and it's the same type of love. You know,
and it was there in that respect. In the midst of all of that, Rory Nolan comes in, the Captain Boyle, one of the great O'Casey characters. You know, any actor is going to want to play that because he has all the great lines. He's very funny. He tells great stories. Yeah. The truth of those stories is another day's work.
Yeah,
but he also, at one point, you know, when things are getting a bit rough outside and the war is raging. Well, that has nothing. That has nothing to do with us.
That has nothing to do with us. And I think, you know, in many ways, he's a victim of his own circumstance, albeit he created his own circumstance as well. And you're dealing with people who really have nothing, and these men who have nothing but the stories that they can create and these worlds that they can lose themselves in, to the detriment of everyone else around them. You know, one of the ways into a character like this, and what's interesting about playing someone like Captain Boyle is that everyone has an idea. Mm. And part of it is that you have to rest that back and just say, right, this is the way we're going to do it. Mm. But one of the ways in was, I mean, and I always find it lends itself brilliantly to comedy, is cowardice. And that cowardice, and I think this goes throughout all the plays, and the cowardice, it can be very funny to watch when you're watching it, but it also has a flip side to it. There's another element to cowardice which is not so funny at all. And the other thing about the captain, and again, I think this goes throughout all of O'Casey's plays, is the idea of that old Irish idea of notions. And the notions that we have about ourselves and the notions that we have as we present ourselves to the world, and how we can get caught up in them so easily and start to believe our own hype. Mm. You know, this is a guy who's talking about sailing from the Gulf of Mexico to the Antarctic Ocean.
An El Collier from Liverpool.
And he's only been on an El Collier from Liverpool. But they have to create a world for them to inhabit that isn't the daily drudgery. And these guys, you know, at the expense of, again, the women in the piece, they're so strong and they're so stoic in the face of everything that's thrown at them. And they are really the heroes.
And as Rory says there, Aaron Monaghan, you're playing Joxer Daly in the production. This idea of cowardice, it's very interesting to watch. How hard is it to play that, you know, because you have to, I guess, find some reason for your character to do what he's doing. And to be the coward that we as an audience can make the judgment on. How difficult is that for the actor? It's a bit like the comedy tragedy thing in the plays as well.
Deliciously easy. Anything. I think Jock's.
What makes it easier? What's the key, please?
Because I only do anything in response to what Rory or Hilda do on stage. Really, you're only responding to what the other actor. I think Joxer is only defined. He only exists because of the captain. And it's funny listening to everyone talk about their characters. I think so much about these plays, so much of these plays are about identity. These characters are obsessed with who they are, who they think they are, who they want to be, who they say they are, which changes constantly over the course of the play with all the given changing circumstances. And I don't know, one of the very exciting things about doing all three plays together is you start out with Plough and the Stars, where there are a myriad, there are dozens of different characters, different ideologies. And when you get to the end of the cycle, those ideologies are shrunken. You're either on one side or the other. And I think it's a really interesting narrative to go from lots of different characters, lots of different ideologies, to something that's kind of binary or nearly singular. And it leaves a big question at the end of the play about the type of world that the remaining characters are going to be going out into. And I don't know if Joxer is going to exist in those worlds.
One of the remaining characters that's definitely going to be going out into the world, because she does, she leaves the set with her mother, is Mary Boyle, who played by Zara Devlin, who's with us as well. She, again, is one of these young women that O'Casey writes. What kind of agency does he give to a young character like Mary Boyle, who's so idealistic in many ways in the beginning, Zara, and then finds herself in a very difficult situation?
Yeah, she's got a great arc. Like, she starts off, you know, you first see her, she's got her books and her mirror and her ribbons, and she's desperately trying to do anything to, you know, I feel like she reads books about being in New York, and I think she dreams, and she doesn't see why she can't live that life, you know, and she's kind of claustrophobic here, and you know, she falls in love with a man who she believes is going to take her to these worlds, and
unfortunately,
then
like
some awful things happen, and she, at the end, she doesn't need anyone but herself, you know.
Yeah, well, herself and her mother, I think, are heading up. As Conor Lenehan was mentioning earlier on, and Gary mentioned it, I think, as well, the great middle scene of Juno and the Paycock is a kind of an internal music hall performance in the tenement building itself. And Juno and Mary, mother and daughter, sing a little duet as part of that party. Zara Devlin as Mary Boyle and Hilda Fay as Juno in that little ditty from Juno and the Paycock. And in some ways, Gary Hines, when you listen to that and you think, what a life that mother and daughter could have had in a different world, in a different social class, where they had a little bit of money behind them to live the life that's described in that song.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, the sense of happiness when they're now in a place where they think they no longer have to scrabble to just get everything, for whether it's basic food or attention. And unfortunately, it's only a momentary sense of a good future. Then life comes and slaps them in the face again.
You mentioned earlier on about the great sadness it must have been for O'Casey when he lost his company of actors at the end of Juno and the Paycock, and that rift that appeared in the Abbey when he was sent off to bring his silver tassie elsewhere. You have created this company of actors, and it's a company of actors that runs across three plays and almost makes it seem like one big play.
Yeah.
How important is that ensemble aspect?
It's without it, this project would not exist, in the sense, I mean, it's It's 18 actors playing a number of roles across the three plays, and obviously it's the talent that the actors bring to it, but also the commitment, understanding, wanting to understand, just the sheer skill and craft and their ability to contact an audience. You know, it's been... I've been so fortunate as a director, and Druid has been so fortunate as a company that we are able, we have been able to assemble such an extraordinary group of people to work on this project.
And one final thing, the O'Casey that you knew before the trilogy, the O'Casey that you know now after directing the three plays of the trilogy?
For me, and I would say that, wouldn't I? But for me, the three plays together have revealed the greatness of the man.
That is it for this Druid O'Casey Arena special. Druid O'Casey continues its run at the Town Hall Theatre here in Galway as part of the Galway International Arts Festival through until this Sunday, July the 30th. You'll be lucky to get a ticket, I would say, though. It will be at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast from August the 5th through to the 19th, at the Abbey Theatre in Dublin from August the 26th through until September the 16th, all before heading out on an international tour with dates in the United States. My thanks to Gary Hines and the cast and creative team behind Druid O'Casey, and indeed to David Milan and Barry O'Brien and the Town Hall Theatre staff, complete and full. For on RTE On Sound this evening, Ciarán Cullen and Mark Dwyer. Today's show was researched by Paula Shields. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back at base, as usual, tomorrow night, 6:30, here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon is on the way.